this morning to you and study with you about mothers, since it is Mother's Day. And the scripture that was read just a moment ago, and if we want to even go back a verse and go a verse further, in Ephesians chapter 6, look at verses 1 through 3. Verse 1 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth." So we have, in the scriptures, the command to honor both our fathers and our mothers. In our country, we have set aside this day, the second Sunday in May every year, which is a different date every year, but always the second Sunday in May, has been set aside for people to honor their mothers. Now, hopefully, as Christians, we won't only honor our mothers on that day. We need to be honoring our mothers and our fathers as well, all through the year. Just as we wouldn't want to honor Christ only on one day. We honor Him all through our lives. We don't even though we come together especially on Sunday to partake of the Lord's Supper and to worship, but even throughout the week, we still are to honor Christ in everything that we do. But our parents, we should be thinking of the same way. And especially today, we think about mothers. And we want to look at some of the mothers in the Bible and see some of the good characteristics, the good traits of those mothers that will be things that will help our mothers and probably help all of us to appreciate, to some degree, our mothers. Not all of us may have had a mother that we thought was the best mother. Some mothers are not as good as others at the task of mothering. But mothers generally love their children immensely. So much so that they would be willing to die for those children, would be willing to do anything to protect those children and to care for those children and do those things that child needs, take care of those needs. Of course, not all mothers are able to do as much as other mothers. But we see in the scriptures several mothers that did some amazing things, and we want to look at some of those. We turn to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 1. We'll see a mother here who was willing to make a great sacrifice. Perhaps you know who that is already. Her name was Hannah. And Hannah was unable to have children for many years. It doesn't tell us how long, but it does tell us that her husband and her were unable to have children. They couldn't have any children. She was barren, it says. And finally, she decided that she needed to have God's help with this situation. And isn't it interesting, today, most of the time when husband and wife can't have children, they don't turn to the Lord for help, they turn to the doctors. Give us some fertility medicine or fix it somehow so we can have children. But this mother-to-be turned to God, and she prayed to God, and she promised God that if God would give her the child that she asked for, that she would give him back, that she would loan him back to the Lord. In verse 11 of 1 Samuel chapter 1, it says, "And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." If you think about that, Samuel must have had some pretty long hair by the end of his life. No razor ever came on his head. But she made that promise to the Lord, "I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life." What a tough decision that must have been. As much as mothers love their children, but she would say, "If you'll let me have him, I'll give him back." but she would still be able to be his mother and to have a son, even though he would be the Lord's. And she was praying and crying, and she was in such a state of distress that when the priest came along, he thought she was drunk. He thought she was had been drinking too much because of the way that she was behaving herself, and she had to explain to him that she wasn't drunk at all, but rather that it was the sorrow that was overwhelming her from not being able to be a mother. You know, in our world today, there are many women who just decide that they don't ever want to be mothers. And it may be that there are some women that just aren't cut out to be mothers in some degree. But what a great desire that is, to want to be a mother, to want to raise children and to bring them up and to teach them and to mold them and to make them into great people, great adults that can then carry on with the ways of the world. But this woman was one of those ones. She was so sorrowful because she couldn't have children. And I have known some women who were unable to have children, and it just nearly destroyed them because they wanted it so badly and yet they were unable to. But I don't know if there is any greater desire in the world of in the physical world than that of wanting to be a mother. And what a great desire that is, to want to do those great things. But of course, it's also a great responsibility. And Hannah recognized that. She recognized that this was a great responsibility, that if she was going to have this child, she was going to have to give the child to the Lord. Now, we don't do as she did. She actually took him to the temple and left him there in the temple after she had weaned him to be trained and to become then God's servant. And he did that. He was the last of the prophets, the last of the judges before the kings. And he was the one who anointed Saul to be king and anointed David also to be king. He was the last of those. Today, as mothers, and you fathers can learn this as well, we still have that same responsibility to give our children to the Lord, but not in the same way. Instead, he gives us the raising of those children. Or somebody said, you don't raise children, you rear children, you raise corn or something like that. But the same idea holds true. He gives us the job, the task of training those children up. But we're supposed to be training them up for him. They belong to him. And many in the world today have fallen short in that area, and they haven't trained their children, haven't even tried to train their children up to obey the Lord. They've trained their children up to serve Satan and to disobey the Lord. So those mothers who strive to train their children up to worship God and to obey God, what a special thing that is, and what a difficult task. Because all of the world around us is pulling in the opposite direction. And we're trying to swim upstream, trying to go in the other direction. And we see another mother, and there are several mothers mentioned in the Old and New Testaments, but we're just looking at a few today. In 1 Kings chapter 1, all of us remember the story of David and Bathsheba and the sin that occurred between them. And their first child, the child that was born as a result of that sin that they committed, died. God took that child's life, even. We talked today about how God doesn't take life, that death comes, that Satan is the bringer of death. But in this case, God actually did take the life. God set that as the punishment for their sin, was that they would lose that child. And certainly that must have distressed them a great deal. David wept and wouldn't eat and wouldn't sleep for days before the child died. And I'm sure Bathsheba was in the same state. She was very distressed over that. But later on, after that, they had another son, a son named Solomon. And Solomon was one of many of David's children. David, of course, had many wives and many children. And Solomon was certainly not the oldest. Normally the oldest was the one that would receive the blessing. And in the case of the king, the oldest son would be the one that logically would become the next king. But David, because of his love for Bathsheba perhaps, or his love for Solomon, because of that, he had promised her that Solomon was going to get to be the king. We look to 1 Kings chapter 1 and verse 15. Bathsheba went in to the king to see the king, and he was very old at that time. And in verse 16, she bowed before him, and he asked her what she wanted. And she explains to him then in verse 17, "My lord, thou swearest by the Lord thy God unto thy handmaiden, saying, Assuredly Solomon thy son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne." This mother is looking out for her son. She knows that the next one to be king is not going to be kind to her and to Solomon. It's kind of the way those things worked back in that time. Whoever became king killed off all of his other brothers and sisters and everybody else that could threaten that throne. And so she knew that that was a danger. In fact, she had gone to talk to Nathan the prophet and had begged him to help her because she knew what would happen. She knew already. One of David's sons, Adonijah, had already set himself up as king. And he wasn't supposed to be the king because David had promised it to Solomon. But here's a mother who's looking out for her son, protecting his interests, and also helping to push him on to be the most and the best that he can be. Now, it is possible, of course, for us to push our children too hard and too far and try to make them to be something that they can't be or even something that they shouldn't be, perhaps. That we try to get them to do all the things that maybe we wanted to do when we were younger, and it may not be the things they want to do. They may not have the same interest or the same ability in those things. Like a father who tries to force his son to play football because he wanted to play football when he was young and he didn't get to. Or a mother who tries to force her daughter to go into a particular field, maybe of work, because she wasn't able to do those things when she was young, because those things maybe weren't open, and yet that may not be what that young lady wants to do. We have to be cautious not to push them too hard and to push them away in those things. But on the other hand, it's very important for us to challenge our children. And those mothers that challenge their children, that push their children to excel, are very pleased with the results. Children, by nature, are somewhat lazy, for the most part. Most children, if you give them the choice between a toy and a book, they'll pick the toy. If you give them the choice later on between watching TV and going out and mowing the yard, they're going to watch TV. All along growing up, if the choice is there between just enjoying the fun things, the simple things, the playing and the games of life, versus learning and working and studying and trying to improve oneself in that way, 99 times out of 100, the child would rather do the fun and games, the way children think. And so we have to push them to some degree to get them to think on serious things. Now hopefully if we train them to those things, then when they grow up they'll continue to want to excel in those things. They'll continue to want to read books and learn things and to be able to work and to provide for themselves and things of that nature. But Bathsheba pushed her son to do and to be the best he could be. And she encouraged the king to help in that. And she encouraged the prophet to help in that. And we need to do everything we can to help our children be the best they can be. Of course, each child may have different skills, may have different ability levels in different areas. And we don't need to expect of them more than what they can give. But we do need to expect the best that they can give. I was talking to a man in one of the shops while we were gone last week, and he was talking about being a little league coach, and there was one particular boy on his team who was just really playing well. He was hitting the ball every time, and he was getting to go on base every time. He was safe every time and would score runs many times. But he realized and he knew that this boy wasn't giving it everything. This boy was just half playing. He said if he'd have really been playing, he could have been doing twice as good as he was. But he just wasn't really putting forth the effort. And so he was always on this child to do better and to work harder. Whereas another child who maybe was striking out, not even hitting the ball at all, or maybe when they hit the ball, getting out and not making it safely to the base. But that child was trying as hard as he could. He didn't expect any more out of that child. And I thought about what he was telling me when he told me that. That fits well with what we need to do as parents. We need to base each child's expectations, the expectations we have for that child, on their own skills and abilities. And not expect more of them than they can provide, more than they can do. But we do need to expect them to fulfill their potential. God expects that of us, doesn't he? Remember the story of the parables? Of the talent, the parable of the talents? One was given 5 talents, one had 2 talents, and one had 1 talent. God wasn't upset at the one who had 2 talents only coming back with 2 more. That's all he expected. He certainly wasn't upset with the one who had 5 talents coming back with 5 more. But what he was upset with was the one who had 1 talent. Not because he just had 1 talent. The reason he was upset was because he didn't use that talent that he had. And as parents, we get frustrated with children sometimes because we see that they could do so much more and do so much better than they are, and they're just not trying. And so they need a little push sometimes. And mothers many times are the ones that give that push, just a little bit of a push to get them going a little further and a little faster and a little harder. And Bathsheba is a perfect example of that. Solomon was a very young man, just a boy, really. He probably didn't think about being king. What a great task that must have been, it seemed to him. Imagine thinking when you were 12, 13 years old, maybe, about trying to be the president. Now, sure, you might think, well, yeah, I could do that. I want to be the president. But you didn't really understand the responsibilities that would go along with being the president. What would be involved? The long hours and all the trips and all the people that you'd have to deal with and all of those things. There's a lot of responsibility there. And the same with being the king. Solomon would have probably much rather continued to be a prince. Being a prince, that was good because you get all the good things, all the benefits. You get to live in the palace. You get to have all the fine food and all the fine clothing, but you don't have the responsibility. How much better that would have been. But Solomon's mother knew that wasn't the road to be taken, and so she pushed. Then when we look to Proverbs chapter 31, know we have heard this and have seen this probably before. Proverbs chapter 31 is something that King Lemuel was taught by his mother. His mother must have been a wise woman as well. But she had taught him some things about how to behave himself. But then she also explains to him, and for all of us as well, some things about the virtuous woman, or the wife of noble character. And this woman is more than just a wife, she's also a mother. But if you look down through, beginning in verse 10 of Proverbs 31, and looking on down through there, we see that she does a lot of things. As much as mothers do today, and I don't doubt that most mothers work twice as hard as the men in this world. But even at that, because of many of the modern conveniences that have been made in the last century, refrigerators, ovens, microwaves even, washing machines and dishwashers and things like that that many women have. Even running water. Think about how much harder it would have been if you had to walk all the way to the creek to get your water and carry it back. All of these things that have been invented along through for the last couple hundred years that have helped to make life easier, and yet still she has a lot of work to do, and she has much to do. But if we look back to this time, look at what this woman is having to do. She is seeking out wool and flax and working willingly with her hands. You know, most of us today go to Walmart or Sears or wherever else and buy our clothes already made. And somebody has made them on a sewing machine or whatever the case may be, and they make hundreds a day. And they have all these fast ways of doing it. Some of you, I think, have even worked in the clothing industry, and you know how that works. It's hard work. But look what this woman has to do. She had to go out and get the wool. She had to go out and get the flax. Flax is a plant that they made linen from, much tougher than cotton. But she had to go out and find these things and then bring it in, and then she had to work with it. She had to get it to work as she wanted it to. She had some hard work to do there. And then it says she is like the merchant ship. She bringeth her food from afar. She had every day. Now see, they didn't have refrigerators, so they couldn't go out and buy a bunch and bring it home and put it in the refrigerator. Every day had to go down to the market and get the food. Every day had to go and get it. And then it says in verse 15, she rises while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maiden. Boy, what a tough thing she had there. She had to get up and start working before the sun even came up. Now most of us get up and start getting ready for work sometimes before the sun comes up, some times of the year, but other times of the year and other days perhaps, we get to sleep in a little bit, or at least the sun is up before we get up. And even but there are others still that work all hours and work long hours. But this woman, she had to get up while it was yet night, and she had to get food ready to feed her family when they got up. And then, verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. And with the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. She plants it by herself. She does it. Boy, this woman's doing a lot of work. So, and yet, if we look at in the world today, and we look at the tasks that mothers have, and many women who work in the secular world as well as working in the home, that's a doubly hard task, because working in the home is a full-time job. Remember the story that was told of the husband and wife, and the man and the woman were arguing about who had the tougher work, and so they said, well, wouldn't it be great if we could just switch? And so they wished that night that, I wish I could just take your place. You've got it so easy. All you do is sit around here all day and watch TV, and you don't have to do anything. I wish I could do that. And you can go off and do my job. And so they trade places for the day. The next day, they wake up and poof, God has changed them so that the man wakes up finding himself in his wife's body. And the wife wakes up finding herself in the man's body. And so they go out through the day. And she, of course, has to get up early, early. Baby's crying. Has to take care of the baby, and then have to fix breakfast and get the husband off to work, and then have to go shopping and have to iron the clothes and wash the clothes and put the clothes away and wash the dishes up and take care of the children and all of these things all through the day. She's just busy, has to take the children to school and go and pick them up from school and all these things. And then she's got to fix lunch and then fix dinner. And by the time she's working on getting dinner fixed, her husband, who's now the wife in the husband's body, comes home. And boy, here we are, not ready for dinner yet, working and working and never getting a break all the day. And then afterwards, of course, we all know what husbands want in the evening time when it's time for bed. And so then as this man in the woman's body is laying there about to go to sleep that night, he says, Lord, please, let me switch back. This was too hard. I had too much to do. And the answer comes, well, that's fine, but you're going to have to wait 9 months because you're pregnant. So, but we don't think about sometimes all of the things that mothers have to do. And we need to be appreciative of them. We need to appreciate our own mothers for what they did. They may not have been the best mother in the world. I assume that there probably is only one best mother in the world. All the rest of us got someone who wasn't. But the odds are pretty good that your mother wasn't the worst mother in the world either. There was only one of those. So all the rest of us are somewhere in between. And yet we realize that she had quite a task raising us and bringing us to where we are now. And we see around us the many mothers who are still working to raise their children. And of course, as husbands, we need to encourage our wives who are trying to raise children. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 15 tells us, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame." Now this is a verse for you fathers, as well as the mothers. Verse 17 also says, "Correct thy son, and he shall give thee rest, yea, he shall give delight unto thy soul." Think about that. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. As fathers and husbands, we know we don't want our wives and the mothers of our children to have to bear shame. The Bible tells us how we can help them to avoid any situation like that. We need to be in control of that child. Rod and reproof. Giving correction, verse 17 says, will bring rest. A mother's job is hard enough when the child is good and obedient. But we've all seen mothers who had disobedient children that they were trying to handle. And especially if they've got two or three, and they're just running around like barbarians and tearing up the house. Every time she gets something cleaned up, they've made another mess. And if she goes to the store, they're into everything and she can't take care of it. Fathers, we must discipline those children and force them to obey their mothers when we're not around. We need to be on her side, not on the child's side. Mothers and fathers are to be a team. The two, the Bible says, shall become one flesh. We're on the same team. Now that's not to say that the children are the enemy, although sometimes it may feel that way. But we're to be doing what we know is best for them. Right after verse 17, "Correct thy son, and he shall give thee rest. Yea, he shall give delight unto thy soul." Now look at verse 18. Look what's next. See, these things kind of flow together, even though they're just proverbs, but they still flow together. Notice verse 18. "Where there is no vision," in other words, where people can't see the impact their actions today are going to have on the future, where they can't look and think about and plan for how things are going to be in the future, where there's no vision, the people perish. We live in a society today where, when it comes to parenting, there's no vision. We look today at parents who do everything for the child. Don and I were reading in a book last night about the family that is child-centered. And everything that child wants, the parents jump. "Oh, we'll do that. We'll get that. Whatever you want." It doesn't work that way. The children are not to be the rulers of the home. The parents are to be the rulers of the home. And the father, as the head of the home, it's his responsibility to make sure that the children are subservient and obedient to their mother, even at times when he's not around. It's his responsibility to make sure of that, so that his wife won't be disgraced in the eyes of others. She won't have to face the shame of taking unruly children out into public and everybody staring as she tries desperately to correct those children. One of the problems related to that is the fact that many of our children today don't have a father. And those fathers, when I say they don't have a father, they did have a father who helped in bringing them into this world, but he hasn't done anything since. And in those cases where there is no father in the home, it's essential for those mothers to find a man, maybe a relative, maybe even their own fathers, the child's grandfather, maybe an uncle, maybe even just maybe someone in the church who can be a role model for that child and can teach that child how to respect and to appreciate their mother. Because children don't do that by nature. We need to think about that. As men, we need to think about the important task we have of helping the mother to receive the honor that she so richly deserves. And we'll look to the New Testament. We see some other mothers, and we'll look over these fairly quickly. In 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5, Paul, writing to Timothy, says, "When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith," or the sincere faith, that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also." You notice how that works? Timothy didn't just get faith. When something just happened to him, it had dwelt in his mother first, and in his grandmother before that. And if Paul could have known his great-grandmother and on back, it probably had gone back even further than that. But that was all Paul knew. Those were the only ones still alive, his mother and his grandmother. But it was clear that his grandmother had taught his mother, and his mother had taught him, and that's why he had the faith in him. Children only have what they're given. They only learn what they're taught. Now sometimes they are taught things inadvertently or by accident. We teach them things when we don't realize we're teaching them, but they're still learning those things that we're teaching. But here, Timothy's mother had passed on the faith, and there's no more important goal in parenting than to pass on to the children the faith that we have. Many times, it may be too late for us. We may already, our children may already be grown before we've come to the faith, or they may be most of the way grown, or partially grown, and so many of those things may be ingrained in them, and it may not be possible to turn that around. But it's important when we have the opportunity, especially those of us who have the opportunity, to start out with those children. And we know that the Bible teaches, and the Bible can teach us how to train them. It's so important that we start teaching them the faith from an early age. Because if we wait until they're grown, they're never going to learn it, because they will have learned another faith before then. They will have learned another system of beliefs, and they will discard the Bible. Then, of course, we all, when we think of mothers, must certainly think of Mary. If you thought you had it tough, mothers, what would it be like to try to be the mother of the Christ child? Oh, what a task that must have been. God must have certainly thought very highly of Mary to put on her that task, being the mother of Jesus. And we must assume that she did a very good job of it, because he's the only one in all of the world, in all of the history of the world, that ever lived a perfect life. Now certainly she doesn't receive all of the credit for that, but she very well could have tried every step of the way to discourage him. She could have tried to tempt him to turn against God and to just be a regular fellow. And at one point, she even is to the point where she is wondering if he is even sane. She wonders if he's not crazy for the way he's acting. There's so many things that must have been going through her mind. Even though God had come and told her that she was going to bear the Christ child, the Messiah, she may not have fully understood all of the implications of that. And time and again, when things happen in the life of Christ, it would say that his mother Mary kept these things in her heart. Many of his brothers doubted him as well when he was growing up and even through his ministry. But we do know that after his death and after his resurrection and his ascension into heaven, in Acts chapter 1, we see that Mary, his mother, is with the disciples. And so it's very clear in chapter 1 and verse 14. It says, "These all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brethren." So his brothers and his mother did trust in him, did finally come to believe that he was who he claimed to be, even though it took them quite some time and that they doubted him at certain points of his life. But then finally in the New Testament, we want to look at one other woman. And this is Elizabeth. So I want to turn to Luke chapter 1. Elizabeth is an interesting character in the New Testament. She wasn't picked to be the mother of the Messiah, which obviously would have brought with it great honor. But instead, she was the mother of the one who was going to introduce him, so to speak. But instead of being jealous of Mary, instead of being disappointed that she wasn't the one chosen, instead, she was quite the opposite. She was very excited for her cousin. In the sixth month, when Mary was six, when Elizabeth was 6 months along, Mary came to be pregnant. That was when the angel showed himself to her. And it's interesting that Mary goes and visits Elizabeth. In chapter 1, in verse 39, the angel has told her that Elizabeth is also going to have a child, a son. And so in verse 39, Mary goes to visit her cousin Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, when she heard Mary just coming in and saying hello, the salutation, when she heard that, the babe, John the Baptist, who was going to be Elizabeth's son, who was still in her womb, says the babe leapt in her womb. And Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Ghost. And she then begins to prophesy something to Mary. And she says, "Blessed art thou among women." And certainly, in some ways, she was very blessed. In other ways, it was a kind of a cursing, too, because of the reproach that she would receive from others for this. But the blessing far outweighed any difficulties that would come along with it. And so she then goes into a long little speech to Mary about the child that Mary is carrying. Elizabeth could have very easily been jealous. Here she is, she's having a baby. Have you ever known this to happen in a family? where two in the family become pregnant, one close to the other, and the first one is so excited, and oh, we're gonna, and then the second one comes along and kind of steals the excitement, steals the glory, or the second one feels jealous because the first one got to have the child first, and all of these kinds of things. But there's none of that between Elizabeth and May. They're both so joyful for each other. And Elizabeth, even though she knew that her son also was one who was going to have to be given to the Lord, he was going to have to be raised in a very special way. He was what they refer to as a Nazarite. Now that's different. Jesus is referred to as a Nazarene. That's because he was from Nazareth. But the Nazarite vow was one that was very strict. John the Baptist would be unable to touch anything dead. No dead animals of any kind. No dead bodies of any kind. He would be unable to eat any of the fruit or juice or anything else that came from the grapevine. And, of course, he would never be able to cut his hair. He was to be a Nazarite. And he even, we read later on, is out in the wilderness eating locusts and wild honey and wearing the skins as clothing rather than the comfortable linen garments that others at that time wore. But, oh, what it must have been for her to know that her son was going to be the one to proclaim that the Christ was coming. But also, some might be very embarrassed by thinking, my son's living out in the wilderness eating locusts and wild honey. He's like a caveman. He's just not normal. But it wasn't so for Elizabeth. And for Mary as well, to be excited for herself and for Elizabeth. And these two show us the great excitement that comes with becoming a mother. Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, sings a song, so to speak. He prophesies because of the greatness of the event. And Elizabeth also had prophesied over the greatness of the event. Elizabeth also, and Mary as well, were willing to give up the chance to have any say in the name of their children. You know, that's one of the biggest things that mothers and fathers look for. What are we going to name the baby when it comes? What are we going to...